Welcome to the CWF Gamecast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is a very special episode. It's very special for a number of reasons. First and foremost, this is the 50th episode of the CWF Gamecast. And it's also special for a strange reason that Jonathan J. Reinhardt isn't actually with me this evening. I don't know whether we should do a tribute to Jonathan J. Reinhardt, but I am joined by a very special co-host, Mr. Stephen McLaughlin. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing? Everybody out there?
I'm doing pretty good. Now, you yourself host a little podcast called What Would Pan Do News from the Front, don't you?
That's right. We've been going just about 6 months now. We have right about 15 episodes under our belt, I think, and it's been a ton of fun.
Very good. So this is actually going to be a regular show in terms of Week in Wargaming contests, but smack bang in the middle we're going to do a little interview with you, because I think the fans want to know a little bit more. And Jonathan seemed to think I was the right person to do the interrogation, so if you see bright lights shining into your face sometime through this podcast, that will be the interview section.
There are four lights.
Very good. So, I'd like to start the show, as we always do, talking about our week in wargaming, and you in particular have had a particularly hectic week in wargaming.
Yes, it was quite a week. So we went to the Cold Wars convention, which is done by HMGS. It's one of the three largest historical miniature conventions on the East Coast. We did a live podcast there. Now, normally I play in the Flames of War tournament that they have going on, but this year I actually opted to sit out, partially because I knew that it would be very exhausting to do the tournament and then immediately turn around and do the podcast. And B, I've never actually been to one of the large conventions and not done the tournament, so I feel like I've kind of missed out on some of the more interesting offerings, all the games going on and the beautiful dealer hall, which is pretty mind-blowingly large.
And there were three big conventions, Historicon, Cold Wars, and one other. Are they responsible for those three?
They are, yes. Fallen is the third.
Yeah. So that's quite a monopoly in terms of kind of big historical conventions.
That's true. They're the ones to get to.
So, yeah, I always feel like I'm in the wrong part of the world for these kind of things. And, yeah, certainly listening to your most recent live recorded show made me realize that, Pennsylvania is a calling.
It's all about Pennsylvania.
So in terms of the show, where I come from in Australia, we have quite a large historical convention annually. And the dealer area and also the, what was the term that you used? Not swap meet, the flea market.
The flea market, yep.
How was that this year?
I actually wound up not buying anything at the flea market this year. We did get to peruse it a little bit early, thanks to our press badges, which was kind of funny. We didn't actually realize that would let us into the flea market a little bit early, but so we got to look through it all when there really wasn't a big crowd. And let me say, when they first opened the flea market, it is shoulder to shoulder with gamers. Mm. As you can imagine, there's maybe a slight funk going on there, but tons of beautifully painted stuff.
So here's a question for you, because Jonathan's just gotten into the Black Powder rule set, and my advice to him, although he didn't take it, was not actually to buy the rules initially, because you need to put all your money into figures early on with Black Powder. And my thinking was that these kind of conventions were in fact the place to buy large amounts of well-painted lead, or at least reasonably, tabletop-ready lead and plastic. In terms of armies and things that were for sale there, was the flea market the place to be?
Yeah, absolutely. Anything you could imagine. I mean, tons of Flames of War stuff, certainly tons of Napoleonics, and just about anything you can imagine. Maybe not quite as much of a representation of Games Workshop games. Didn't see too much 40K. There was a little, but you could definitely come away with a full army. And in fact, one of the guys that does our podcast, Luke, he kind of waited until the last minute of the flea market, and he got an insane deal. I think he got 40 Shermans, 40 Battlefront Shermans for like $50.
Unbelievable.
And he walked away with a ridiculous deal.
That is absolutely insane. The Black Powder period is, I think, from Napoleonics up to even the Boer War, which is like kind of the edge of last century. So a long period that one, but the main thing is that you do need large armies.
Right.
And I was thinking, particularly Historicon, Historicon's got to have a pretty impressive flea market as well. And I was thinking of the conventions that Jonathan could pick up a reasonable sized army for the right price. And of course, Luke made this is like going and buying fish, because basically you want to wait till the last minute to get the really good deals on the armies. Very similar to
right.
buying fish at a fish stall. You wait until the last minute where they can't give the stuff away, and then you buy it big. And that's very smart. That's a smart move. But he could have also, I think for particular things that might be a little bit risky. So yeah, if you're not particularly choosy, maybe that's the right move.
Yeah, and the thing is, he didn't really need them. I mean, it was last minute, and he was like, well, this guy's still selling them. I'm going to try to get them for a price where I just can't refuse them. But I think if you were going, with the goal of really walking away with an army, you could definitely do it well-painted for a very reasonable price and make sure you get what you want.
Very good, very good. So I guess my advice holds true, and it's going to be interesting. We're going to have Henry Hyde and Neil Shook on the show, and they have first-hand experience in the UK doing exactly the same thing, and I'm interested in getting their advice as well, because my sense is that if you want to get into, you have a very strong line on the What Would Panda News from the Front podcast associated with self-painting and, anti-Silver Surfer kind of methodologies, but for folks
right.
such as myself and Jonathan, my background is, I can kind of do a reasonable paint job when I need to. But it's actually, I found in the past, a lot more interesting to employ eclectic painters to do some of my stuff. I think in Jonathan's case, he's just looking for sheer painted volume up front so he can start exploring the rules. And
right.
Did you get the sense that any of these armies were from, like, deceased estates or anything? Or do you get the sense that they were all just, like, game of turnover armies?
I think most of them were turnover. I think it was just people kind of trying to pay for their own trips, really, up to the cons. I got that sense a lot, that people were more like, if I can come home and break even, having paid for my ticket, having picked up a couple, little trinkets here and there, maybe some swag, and at the same time I can clean out some space, then I'll be a happy man. So I think more so than not, it was people kind of selling off the untouched parts of their personal collections. But that's just the sense I got.
Hmm. So was there a lot of unpainted stuff as well?
Not as much in the flea market.
Hmm.
Certainly some, but a lot of it was, in fact, painted. I would say maybe 60 to 70% painted.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And
the point you touched on, Historicon is, I believe, the largest of the three. So this flea market is maybe half the size of Historicon's. So it definitely will be able to meet just about anybody's needs. I mean, anything you want to buy, you should be able to find at the flea market. I'd be real surprised if you couldn't find anything particular.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in terms of ancients and medieval stuff, was there much stuff at the flea market, or was it more kind of from Napoleonics on?
Yeah, I saw mostly Napoleonics on. I can't even remember any specific ancients armies that I saw now. Thinking back, but of course the weekend is a little bit hazy, so.
Yeah, I'm interested in American Civil War as well, and my sense is Historicon in particular would be a good place to pick up American Civil War armies, probably what I loved, so yeah.
I think you're right. I saw a lot of ACW games, but again, I didn't see that many ACW figures. I did see at least one table selling ACW, but a lot of games were played of ACW, so.
Cool.
And I think you're right, probably. Historicon, just being larger, it's going to draw the people there.
Very good. Very good. So in terms of the rest of your week in wargaming, have you been able to do any painting, or has it just been recovery?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a funny thing. Because I didn't play in the tournament this year, typically I come home from one of these big conventions, and I think, I don't even want to look at my gaming stuff for at least a week, And this had the complete opposite effect, having not played in the tournament, but kind of talking shop with the guys, so to speak, and buying a couple of new things here and there. I actually, pretty much the night I got home, I broke out the paints, and I've been painting ever since. I just finished the last of my French army for Flames of War. And thank you. It's quite the feat, always finishing an army. So I came home actually very, very pumped up.
So, I mean, through the interview portion of the show, I'm going to ask you a number of questions associated with your army composition and general tactics. But okay. I'm curious, with your French army in particular, do you, in terms of the actual army itself, do you think you'll field all of it in all battles, or do you keep a kind of flexible 25 to 50% in reserve that you move around? What's your strategy with your French army in particular?
Well, I'll tell you this, with the French infantry, I don't really have a handle on them yet, because that was kind of the last pieces of the puzzle I had to get done. I've had the core infantry done, but I haven't had their integral support. So I'm just now finishing the HMGs, the mortars. So I can't really speak to them, but what I have been using is French armor. And what I'll say about French armor is it's all about grabbing and holding the initiative. If you let your opponent take control of the initiative, you're going to lose. And the reason is the French tanks in Flames of War have a special rule called one-man turret. And that rule is that if you move, your main gun cannot fire. The idea is that it was just too overwhelming for this one commander. He had to both, you know, guide the troops and fire the gun. So with that in mind, you've really got to look at the board. You've got to anticipate where your opponent's going to go. You've got to control the tempo of the battle and make sure that you fight where you want to fight. And the times that I've lost with the French armor has been the times that my opponent has seized the initiative and kept me sort of reacting to him rather than being active.
Very good, very good. So you've actually been able to kind of battle test the army as you paint.
Yeah, absolutely. I started with armor because I can get it painted so quickly. So I actually have several different companies I can run of the French. And I've really settled on the list that I've come to just absolutely love is the French. And I'm going to try to pronounce this. I'm sure someone's going to call me out. I believe it is Escadron de Reconnaissance.
Yeah,
that's the reconnaissance squadron.
Yep.
Close enough, right?
Yep.
And it's basically just a mass of these Panhards, the Panhard AMD 35. It's one of my favorite vehicles of World War II, so I felt like I had to have them. And this list, because they're pretty crummy, they come in mass. I just have a ton of them. And they're zipping around, and they're recon, so they're very mobile. And I've really come to like that list. And I've played it a number of times, and I think I'm undefeated with it so far. It's great. I can get anywhere on the board. I can bring the fight to the enemy, or if need be, I can move the fight to anywhere else. And I'm really smitten by this list.
So do you think infantry is just going to mess that up?
Well, I've used infantry supporting it, and the infantry can be quite nice. The French have the option to take colonial infantry where they're fearless and they're better in assaults. And that's fits my play style, is I'm very aggressive and like to get right into people's faces. So I like troops that are very aggressive like that. And to that end, that infantry is actually really quite reliable and quite solid. Being fearless and hitting on three up in assault as if they were veteran troops while paying the prices of trained troops means they're actually a very solid unit. So I'm looking forward to trying out the full infantry company and seeing it will be a different play style because they're certainly going to be far less mobile, but I think they're going to be still very aggressive, maybe a good counterpunch list. So I don't feel like they're going to slow me down or that they're going to hurt my style, but I do feel like there may be a little bit of a learning curve as I try to kind of slow it down, I guess.
Yeah, it also almost goes against what you were saying initially with regards to the initiative component as well. So no, that's going to be very interesting. We're kind of digressing into the interview, so I probably should return to the week in wargaming component.
Sure, sorry.
Not a problem. No, it's me that's leading the charge here. So in terms of my week in wargaming, it's been a heavy writing week for me. We're kind of a week out of phase, which means I record an episode, but it hasn't actually hit the feed yet. So kind of following on from that episode, lots and lots of writing. I've got this one book that's come out, and the time frame associated with it actually getting to stores is longer than I anticipated. So I had the option of kind of either working on the sequel or working on the role-playing game rules, and I've been working on the sequel quite heavily because this is something that's fitting together, lots of additional documentation. So that's been my week, aside from a couple of books that I've read in parallel. My mind has gone completely blank. In addition to this, we've gotten some interesting correspondence from Henry Hyde, and it'll be wonderful having Henry on in a future podcast. It is actually really quite amazing. I mean, Henry Hyde, Neil Shook, these kind of people. In fact, truth be told, the reason that I'm appearing on this podcast currently is because Henry and Neil haven't been recording podcasts of relatively great frequency, and I just needed to kind of kick things up. But it'll be wonderful having Henry on the show in the near future, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that he can bring. And similarly, Neil Shook, who I'm hoping actually to record an episode with this Friday. So that should be hitting the feed relatively soon as well. But yeah, relatively flat week for me. I'm pretty sure I actually got the paints out and did something this week. But again, my mind has gone relatively blank because we do have a special guest on this evening. And I'm a huge fan of the What Would Patton Do News from the Front podcast. I've recorded a promo or two for them. So it's just a real pleasure to have Stephen McLaughlin on. And without further ado, Stephen, how did you get into wargaming?
Let's see. Well, when I was maybe 14 or 15, one of my friends bought some Avalon Hill games. And one of those in particular was, I believe, World at War. Mm-hmm. And if you remember that, it's one of those just sprawling, massive games. And we laid it out on the table, and something kind of clicked. I mean, even at that age, I kind of liked playing video games and stuff. And looking at this grand tactical view of World War II and really having a tenuous grasp on the rules, because frankly, they were complicated, and I don't think we ever fully understood what we were doing. But I just loved it. I mean, I loved that we were kind of hanging out together and playing a game. And that's really where it spawned. Shortly thereafter, all my friends really got into 40K.
Mm.
And I got into it, and I played it. And it never really scratched that itch. It's not that I dislike sci-fi. I can't even really put my finger on it. Something about it just didn't quite appeal to me. I played fantasy as well, and I liked that significantly better, but something was still...
Did you play in 40K?
I played Tyranids, and I played Imperial Guard.
Oh, interesting. Interesting combination.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and I think that probably stems from the fact that Aliens is probably my favorite movie of all time, so I kind of recreated that in 40K as close as I could, I suppose.
Hmm. So in terms of your playing of 40K, which army came first?
I think that was my Tyranids. Yeah, it was my Tyranids. Those were the first miniatures I ever painted, and looking back, they were pretty crummy, but yeah, you know, what can you do? Got to start somewhere.
Yep.
And I don't know that... I guess part of the problem with 40K for me was that we never seemed to have a whole lot of fun in the games, only because we felt like the list making was where that game was won or lost. Mm. There were times when I would go up against a certain list and I would just always win, and it was never close. And then there were lists that would just absolutely wipe the floor with me. And I don't know that we ever really came to that point where it's like, man, this could go either way. It was more turn two, you kind of know who's going to win. And that's probably, honestly, my own fault. We probably didn't fully understand the rules, or we didn't work together well enough.
It's also a function of the Tyranids, fundamentally. I mean, the Tyranids in terms of just kind of grabbing the board, basically, and sucking everything into their path. I mean,
right.
they're very much that style of play, and certainly my early games were always against Tyranids, and it was really a kind of move, shoot, back away, shoot, back away, as this kind of flood of things came towards me.
Right.
But I guess, yeah, it's an interesting game in that regard, because you're right. What you pick ultimately defines a large portion of it. And when you moved into Imperial Guard, that's a completely different play style.
It was, yeah. And ultimately, I don't think I ever really found my play style with either of those lists. I probably didn't realize exactly the way I wanted to be playing in that time frame. It probably didn't make sense until I started playing Flames of War. Hmm. So looking back, I feel like I could probably do better with them now. And again, I was pretty new to wargaming, but we all were. So
So you mentioned fantasy as well. What fantasy armies did you play?
I only had Imperials.
Oh, okay, well. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. What can I say? I kind of like going with the, not necessarily the underdog, but kind of the middle-of-the-road guys, mm-hmm. sort of the baseline. And I just thought they were really cool. And I will say, they were absolutely a blast to paint. They were some of the first models that I really, really put it all into. And the end result was really quite beautiful. I was very proud of them. Mm. Not so proud of them on the battlefield, but that's neither here nor there.
Interesting. So after Fantasy and 40K, how old were you roughly through this period?
I guess that was maybe on and off 4 or 5 years.
Okay. So you did it into college?
Yeah, I did it into college. And then I can't remember how we came across it. I think it was maybe one night after playing a game of 40K, I was thinking, you know, I would really, really like to play a World War II version of this.
Hmm.
And so I basically, I don't even think it was Google. I think it was like Alta Vista then or something. I searched for, you know, World War II miniature game, and I found this fledgling game called Flames of War.
So
and at the time,
that?
You know, I'm really bad at remembering exact years. I want to say it was 2001, could have been 2000. And at that time, it was PDFs. I think the big news of the day was that the first edition was about to come out, so it may have been a little later than that. And the first edition did come out about a few months into our diving into it.
So that's an awfully long time, 10 years, basically.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it has been about 10 years. And I did put it off for a while. For probably 2 years, I kind of put it away. I moved to Richmond, and I didn't bring my Flames of War stuff with me, and I kind of forgot about miniature gaming for a while. At that time, I was going to school, I was working full-time, and I was in a band, and we were touring, playing weekend shows and stuff. So miniature gaming just didn't even enter my mind. And I don't remember what flipped the switch again, but it was 2005 when I really picked it back up.
Interesting. So I was going to talk a little bit about your music, because that's obviously a large part of your life as well. What kind of genres have you played?
So my first band was surf rock, something like The Ventures or something, if you can imagine that. And that was a ton of fun. I was in that for a few years, and we toured quite a bit. And then the band after that was really a strange sort of folk narrative storytelling type band, and it was Old West themed, but it wasn't really country music. It's kind of hard to describe. I've thought about putting the music up on the blog one day. Maybe I still will. But that was a ton of fun. We were at it for quite a long time, did a lot of big tours, and just kind of wrote silly songs about cowboys and stuff, which I think made it easier. I think it's almost a cop-out because we never really wrote about anything that mattered or, you know, anything that we actually cared about. It was all, you know, about gunfights and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it kind of took the pressure off us to where we could always be like, no, but this is a joke, even though the songs got rather serious. We had we put out a 7-inch vinyl, and it was we sort of told the story of the Battle of Mine Creek in the Civil War, which was I think I was 4th Cavalry. I don't even remember the specifics anymore. So it was kind of weird that we were like these young guys playing in these bars but singing songs about the Civil War, basically. So
fair enough. And was that your last band?
Yeah, that was the last band. Other than I've dabbled a little bit here and there, kind of sat down and written some songs. But ultimately, I haven't really played any music in about 2 years now.
It's interesting because certainly I mean, my compositions for podcasts and things have reinvigorated my own musical stylings, and it's an interesting phenomena to, I guess, to have listeners to kind of eclectic bits of music that one can write through either intro or outro music or a wide variety of other things. So, yeah, it would be interesting, actually, to hear some of your music through the podcast.
Sure. Did you write the new CWF intro music?
No, I didn't, actually. I'm a bit disappointed in Jonathan. I'm not sure if this will make the show, actually, because when I criticize him, he doesn't edit. He edits those bits out. But, yeah, I was a little bit disappointed that I couldn't actually have the opportunity to write the music associated with the show. But, no, that's not one of my compositions. So no, Jonathan picked that one, and funnily enough, the little 3-chord piano thing that he uses for the gaps is actually from one of my compositions, but I can't actually find it. He found it in, like, I don't know, a 6-minute song. He just clipped out that little bit and I think sped it up a little bit. So yeah, I would honestly like to do a lot more musically for the CWF Gamecast. Maybe when we formally change our name to Monty and the Fox, I'll be allowed to do some proper composition for that. But yeah, Jonathan, this one goes out to you. The ball's in your court, mate. Anyway, so you were playing in bands, and then somewhere 2005-ish, did you reclaim your miniatures, or how did you get back into...
So I left most of my stuff at my parents' house. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember exactly what it is that sparked my interest, and I don't know that there was really one specific point. I think maybe it had kind of been nagging at the back of my mind. And ultimately one day I was like, you know what, I'm going to get back into this. And so
The Band of Brothers came out. I'm just trying to think what in popular culture was going on at that time.
Yeah, that could have been it. I guess at that time was also when I met my wife. So we had been together for maybe about a year then. So I don't know, maybe I felt like I, you know, could go ahead and pull that out of the closet, so to speak.
I know how that goes, believe me.
Yeah. So maybe that has part of it or something to do with it as well. But I basically went home, grabbed it all, brought it back. And this was, I think, right around when the first Late War book was coming out. Maybe right around then.
So what did you have in your collection up until this point?
At that point, we had been focusing on mid-war, because in those early days, that's really what Flames of War was focusing on. So it was mid-war in the desert, which I actually have come to be I've really come to love that period. And before Flames of War, I didn't really fully grasp what happened in North Africa. I mean, I knew about it, but I certainly was not much of a history buff. But Flames of War kind of pushed it. And so I had Americans, I had a tank company, I had armored rifles, and the fledgling beginnings of a regular rifle company, and they were sort of based on Tunisia. And so then I had the Africa Corps to oppose them. And my father actually had some 8th Army British. We got him into the game, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, my grandfather was in the 8th Army, so I have a particular connection there. In fact, there's a funny story which I told last podcast, which hasn't come out yet, where my grandfather stumbled across a German tank early in the desert conflict and went inside, and there was a camera inside, which he continued to take photographs for the remainder of the war. So my uncle has all these photographs that my grandfather took with this German camera. I'm not sure of this, but my hope is that the previous owner of the camera's photographs are also included, although I'm not sure how my grandfather would have felt about that. So my dream is to go, he lives in rural Australia, my dream is to turn up there one day with a scanner and just get all the photographs scanned digitally, because he keeps them in obviously good condition. But yeah, no, it's a conflict that I have a very close familial connection to in that regard. But anyway, continue, sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very cool. That's really cool. I'd like to see those pictures if you ever do that. But yeah, so we all had desert stuff, basically. So that's where I started. Then when late war came out, I decided I was going to paint some Germans, you know, tigers and panthers and that sort of thing. And then from there, I mean, it's just exploded. So.
And in terms of the distinctions between mid-war to late war, it's something that's always struck me that the systems and the methods of play and all these things are really refined around these three periods now.
Right.
Do you think really they are distinct periods fundamentally, aside from obviously the geography? Or do you think that some of the tactics that could be cultivated in mid-war would also help for late war?
Yeah, I think mid-war and late war especially are really quite similar. And especially if you're playing a list from later part of mid-war or the early part of late war, there's really barely any difference. It's really just a balancing act to get the points to where they're acceptable. You know, if they didn't break it up into the period, in order to make a balance, you'd have tigers being, you know, one tiger could be your entire army versus 100 crusaders or whatever. But fundamentally, I think, especially in mid and late war, the game doesn't change much. I think early war has kind of thrown that for a loop because there's much poorer firepower, and the anti-tank rating of most weapons are much closer to the armor ratings of vehicles. Mm. So ultimately, early war is much less lethal, which I think is pretty historically accurate. You have tanks getting hit and not blowing up, whereas in late war, just about any gun that hits another tank, especially if you're the Germans, is going to blow up whatever you're shooting at. So I do think early war plays a little differently, and I'm not sure that I've played enough yet to really speak to that. I only have maybe 10 games under my belt for early war. But actually, I think mid and late war are pretty close to each other. I think, except for just what units are available, it's really kind of the same game, and I like that a lot. So it really lets you focus on what theater you want to play.
And in terms of your particular collection, I don't know whether mistake is the right term, but you've put up on YouTube your particular portions of your collection through extensive walkthroughs, which, from my perspective at least, usually leaves a pile of saliva either in my lap or on the table as I'm looking at it, these kind of things. It is a pretty impressive collection by anyone's standards. The fact that you've described that it's taken you, well, maybe 5 to 10 years to actually assemble that collection makes me feel a little bit better.
Right.
But in terms of, I mean, you seem to have almost every period and every army covered. Was that a conscious decision, or are you just someone who likes to kind of explore different rules, and the only way that you can explore them is actually by purchasing and painting the various forces?
No, that was very conscious. Always, ever since I was young, I'm the kind of guy that finds a toy and I think, man, this toy is really cool. I probably need to get two so that my friend can play too. So I really like having the opposing forces when I can. So typically you'll see if I start, say, late war British, well, that means I need to work on my late war Germans. And now for early war, I'm finishing up my early war French, and guess what's now on the painting table? Early war Germans. So yeah, that's why. I really like to be able to have people over and you know, say, what do you want to play? I have it all. You pick. I'll pick my army. And then we go at it, and they don't have to necessarily bring their own stuff. Or if they're working on their armies, I can fill in the gaps. So I guess I kind of like being the provider, I guess, in that role. And you're right. I have just about every army, except I have no Soviets.
I was going to ask about that, because that, I think, in terms of just a different play style, is really the army that probably lends itself to a very particular kind of player. Is that what you feel with regards to the Soviets?
I think it lends itself to a very particular kind of painter, a masochistic one. They just field so much infantry, particularly, and I paint infantry slowly, so that honestly is the primary reason I have yet to do Soviets, because I know that it will take me forever. But you're right, I think they're maybe a little less subtle than some of the other armies, because their unit of maneuver is a company rather than a platoon. You typically have four or five massive blobs on the table, and there's not much to do other than charge. Which I like. I like that aspect. I think that would suit me, or at least that I would find it fun and humorous. So there's no real reason that I haven't got them, other than the fact that I'm not yet committed to painting like 300 15mm guys to my standards.
That's interesting, because I don't know whether it was tongue-in-cheek, but certainly in your last recording you mentioned that you were interested in getting VC for the Vietnam.
Yeah, and I've decided that if I do that, I'm going to paint them pretty much at the lowest acceptable quality for myself, which is basically slap the color on, do a wash, do a couple of highlights. And I wasn't excited at all about Vietnam, but I think if some of the guys around here kind of drum up interest for it, I could be talked into playing the VC. I'm not sure, though. I'm not sure that that my drunken ramblings can be taken for contractual agreements.
Very good, very good. I'm personally interested in the VC, just because I think their tactical style is probably going to be very interesting and akin to how different the Soviets are, probably different yet again.
Right.
And the thing that interests me through some of your more technical discussions on the What Would Patton Do News from the Front podcast is associated with, I guess, notions of force and also perhaps is studying the historical tactics used. And I think this is something that certainly when you listen to like 40K or fantasy, Warhammer Fantasy podcasts, they don't have the same reverence for history and tactics and actually using this to their advantage. Can you talk a little bit about the historical perspective in terms of thinking about tactics? Do you read a lot of historical books associated with tactics, or is that really more done by others on the podcast?
I don't read too many specifically about tactics. I tend to read more about units. So I just finished Iron Hull's Iron Hearts, which is about the Italian armored divisions in the desert. And so I've researched tactics, but ultimately I don't really necessarily read real world tactics and apply them to my game. It's more that I kind of think about the game and find that my tactics tend to align with certain particular schools of thought. But in our last episode, one of the guys who does our podcast, John, was talking about the U.S. infantry's decision to go to the triangle shape, which is basically they have three companies. And the idea with them is that you reinforce success rather than reinforcing failure. And he pointed out to me, and this, not all of this was necessarily recorded, he and I had a conversation afterwards, that he sort of watched my games and he sees that I do that. And it's, I'm not sure if it's something I've necessarily consciously thought of. I haven't been doing it and thinking, you know, what I need to do is reinforce my success. It's more kind of off the cuff, which I think I tend to play. I almost equate myself with Rommel. I think I'm pretty good at just kind of quickly being like, well, right there, I'll do that, and that should work. So it's almost unconscious for me. But anyways, to get back to the point, I tend to not actually apply real world tactics that much, at least not beyond sort of a surface level. I'm better at really kind of fully understanding the Flames of War rules and understanding what I can do within that concept. And that doesn't mean that I'm a rules lawyer or looking for sort of cheesy things to do, to use some parlance of our times. I guess in terms of historical tactic applications, I'm really not the guy that does that. I think it's more happenstance that I've aligned with that.
And it's interesting because you mentioned computer games, and what you're describing here is almost the intuition that you get from playing a certain number of these heavily strategic or tactically based computer games. In terms of the games that you used to play or even play to this day, What were some of them, and do you think they affected your gameplay style for Flames of War?
Yes, I think they absolutely have, and I think I can pretty much credit that straight away to StarCraft. I don't know if you remember that.
Certainly.
And I still to this day play the first StarCraft, and I still have a blast with it, and I'm still always finding sort of new little strategies and new build orders and things. And I've probably logged, just thousands of hours playing that game. That in particular. I've played other strategic games. I'm trying to think of any off the top of my head. Certainly all the Warcrafts. What else is there? The Red Alerts. Those were good. And then some turn-based games, which I think you and I have had a few discussions on. And ultimately, that's something I'd like to explore more, because I haven't really played that many, mostly the Daisen Ryaku series. But I do think that the real-time strategy games, especially playing against a human opponent, does have a lot of the same principles as wargaming does, is you sort of try to grab the initiative, put your opponent off, catch him flat-footed, that kind of thing. And so I do think there's a lot of carryover there.
Yeah, it's interesting, because certainly that was the thing that that gelled with me as you were describing your actual tactics. So in terms of podcasting, when did you first start listening to podcasts? What were the initial podcasts that you started listening to, and how did you get into this mode that you were going to start recording what would pattern to the news from the front?
Well, this will certainly show how much of a noob I am to podcasting. To be honest, before we started, the only podcast I listened to with any regularity was This Week in Tech, which I still listen to. I still like it a lot. And that was really it. I just never really realized that there were so many podcasts, and certainly there were podcasts about gaming. And what happened was one night I was sort of rearranging some things, and I saw all my recording equipment. I thought, man, wouldn't it be great to get out my recording equipment? And so my friend Sean came over, and I was like, hey, let's record a podcast tonight. And he was like, well, what's a podcast? And then we kind of talked about it, and we just did it. And then right after that, I sort of started researching, and I found all these podcasts to fill any niche you want. I mean, we've even at my work now, we've started a podcast, and it's great. I love it. I've probably only been listening to podcasts for 5-6 months now. I'm very new to it.
Amazing. That's amazing in terms of turnaround. Yeah, this month, actually, in fact, a couple of days ago, it's like my fifth year of podcasting.
Oh, wow.
And it's a form that I'm very receptive to, obviously, and I've kind of honed, I don't know, whatever vocal skill I might have around a variety of different podcasts. But ironically, the CWF Gamecast was one of the first podcasts that I listened to. And I really liked Jonathan's pretty eclectic style. Now, if you imagine how Jonathan is now, I'm not sure if you've heard any of the early podcasts, but he had a particular style back then. Some of that's been rounded off recently. It's very appropriate that we're talking about this for the 50th show. It's very interesting, because I think there are, certainly my experiences early on, where there were a lot of mistakes that people could make with regards to, firstly, getting a podcast out, but secondly, things like actually where the audio is hosted. And I know, not the last show, but the show before last, you guys were kind of lamenting some of the costs involved with podcasting. And
Right. That
oftentimes is something that befalls people who, as you've described, have just set up recording equipment and put out the audio. For my own stuff, I'm not sure about Jonathan's setup, but I use the Internet Archive for hosting, which is free, basically.
Huh.
High bandwidth. If you're familiar with the Internet Archive in terms of their Wayback engine, and they have like all the book stuff on file. So basically you can put audio on there, and my one podcast, Model Rail Radio, has like 14,000 listeners, and it grows at about 20% a month. Like, it's just insane kind of
Very product. Nice.
And the only way I could do that legitimately is through the Internet Archive. I couldn't actually like put it on a website or anything, because it would just cost me money, like real insane amounts of
Right.
money. So I guess my concern, particularly as you guys get bigger, is that these kind of costs are going to come ramping towards you. And certainly from what you described last show, and you mentioned that there was even like a cost associated with getting listed on iTunes.
No, I don't think there's. I think Luke might have said that mistakenly. I think mostly the costs he's referring to are a lot of the prizes we do. We send out quite a few T-shirts here and there. Mm-hmm. But you are right. It's a little bit of the hosting. And I use MobileMe, and I just realized that there's I am approaching my monthly transfer cap. And so actually, I was not aware that you could get free hosting at that site. So that's something we'll definitely have to research.
Yeah, but archive.org is the place. And particularly as you guys grow rapidly, I mean, the things that I've seen, unfortunately, with a number of podcasts is that they don't have the free hosting. Or maybe they go through Libsyn or one of these other services. And then they start hitting these ridiculous caps. I mean, Neil Shook from Meeple's Miniatures is a good example of that. That basically, as the show got more and more successful and he wanted to record more and more shows, Libsyn was saying, you're going to have to pay us $250 a month in order to get stuff hosted. It was just insane.
That is insane.
And I think also some of the other podcasts that I listen to that have grown rapidly have tried a wide variety of things to get their audience to basically support them. And it's a mistake that I've seen. I've seen podcasts literally implode based on this. I'm not sure, clearly, because you haven't been listening to podcasts for long, but there was, before the current instance of 40K Radio, there was a previous instance of 40K Radio where everything got out of control, and then the IRS got involved and basically shut down the podcast.
So wow.
there are a number of pitfalls that people can get into in terms of these things. But certainly, I mean, what Jonathan does with sponsorship and what most of the podcasts do with ads and these kind of things, I don't think there are many problems with. But you just need to basically work out how you can minimize all your costs associated with it. Otherwise, there will come a point where, and I've found this, I mean, I did Model Rail Radio in a format very much similar to another podcast that I'd recorded for 4 years previously. And it was to do with live call-in and all these kind of elements. So it's kind of chaotic, but it records a long show that people listen to. And the format that I found particularly problematic was that basically these shows where they had private hosting, where they did all of these things, and then they started saying, well, unless the listeners send in, you know, a dollar a listener or whatever, we won't be able to continue. And these kind of things. So there are various pitfalls. And it's interesting that you've gotten into it. I mean, certainly in terms of audio equipment, in terms of these kind of things, in terms of the general form. And Twitter's pretty good for that. But I guess, yeah, there are certain pitfalls. So feel free. I mean, obviously, Jonathan's been doing it just as long as I have, although we come to it from slightly different perspectives. But, I mean, if you have these kind of issues, feel free to... you know, to contact some of us greybeards associated because that's interesting, actually. So, in terms of you've discovered podcasts now.
That's right.
Aside from CWF Gamecast, which clearly you're a huge fan of.
That's right.
What other podcasts do you listen to?
Well, I listen to Podhammer. I listen to Warhammer Radio, and those are interesting because I'm not even all that interested in Warhammer. And
neither are the hosts of Podhammer currently. So.
That's true. They're very much into War Machine and Hordes right now. Mm-hmm. So I listen to those. I listen to the D6 Generation. Mm-hmm. I listen to you guys. Who else do I have? Of course, the Battlefront Now have a podcast, which I find funny. Let's see. I guess that's really about it. I mean, I've explored other ones, and none of them really stuck with me, so I can't think of any off the top of my head that I eagerly await to download, and I guess I could open iTunes here and see what else is in there, but those are really the ones that I look forward to.
Interesting. Yeah, the Podhammer guys in particular, it's funny, talking about Pennsylvania, the Brandon DiCamillo promo that they got, I've worked with Brandon and a few of the other Jackass-related guys about the same long length of time that I've been podcasting. So when they started playing the Beastman and Skeletor thing, I contacted Brandon and arranged the promo. So that immediately identified me to Jeff. And he's actually coming through Vegas. So my hope is that I'll be able to record with him when he's here. Although he will probably be even more inebriated than you were in your last podcast. I'm not sure whether it'll make good podcasting, particularly for the kind of highbrow listenership of the CWF Gamecast. So that may have to be, I don't know whether we'll be able to get that in. But yeah, I'm interested in meeting Jeff because, I mean, certainly he's been doing it for about 3 years now. And what he does very well, as you guys do, is actually give some tactical analysis, or he used to. I mean, he's moving back towards that form. But if you listen to his earlier shows, there was a lot of tactical analysis, which I thought was actually quite fascinating. And I would recommend for people who didn't even play Warhammer that they'd listen to Podhammer just to get a sense of, as you guys do in some regard, basic dissection of rules, looking at strengths and weaknesses with various armies, looking at army interactions and these kind of things. And I think Jeff, through in large part the quality of the guests that he got through, and also the style of play in Australia is quite a bit different to the style of play in the UK and the US for pretty well all war games, but Warhammer in particular. And that was something that I really gelled with initially with Jeff's Podhammer, was that it was a play style that I remember actually experiencing in Australia, and I've never been able to replicate it either in the UK or here. They take the game seriously, but just not too seriously.
Right.
And yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so they're the podcasts you listen to. So I have one final question associated with Cold Wars in particular. You met a hero of mine, Bill Wilcox. I'm not sure if you've known Bill for a long period of time, but I'm a fan of Bill's work and fan of Bill's writing. In terms of sitting in the presence of the man, what more do you get from being in his presence that you don't get from all the articles and army painting photographs and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, he is just honestly one of the most genuine guys you'll ever meet. And I've run into him for quite a few years because he tends to hit all the Flames of War tournaments. He's absolutely the best. I've kind of sat and talked tactics with him, and he sort of reinforced a lot of my beliefs about Flames of War. But most importantly, every time you run into him, he's just the nicest guy. Remembers everyone's name, comes over, he'll chat with everybody, and people are just vying for his attention. As you probably know, he just works a room so effortlessly because he's just such a genuine guy. I can't say I know him much more than that. We're certainly not, you know, close friends or anything, but every time we hang out, there's plenty of good chat. Maybe someone buys a round of drinks, and it's always a good time, really good time.
Very good, very good. You don't need to specify what company he works for, but I am very curious the industry that he works in that enables him to get to so many different conventions.
Right. He works for a software company, and they basically have clients all over the place. And from what I understand is he's high enough to where he can sort of say, hey, I think that client in Pennsylvania really needs me to come visit them on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then, by the way, I'll just take Thursday, Friday, and Monday off. And I think that's pretty much how he swings it.
Very good. And he also swings his trips to New Zealand and the UK.
So that's right. Oh. Yeah, I believe so. Well, I'm not sure about New Zealand. I'm not sure how that worked out.
They do have software in New Zealand, you know.
They do, yeah, but I think they mostly have sheep, so yeah. I guess they need software to track their sheep. So
Perhaps. Very interesting. So as the interview section of the recording winds down, is there anything else you want to leave with the CWF Gamecast listenership?
Sure, well, I first want to thank you for having me on. I've certainly enjoyed listening to you guys cast, and I really enjoy the promo you did for us. It always makes me snicker when it comes on.
Very good.
Frankly, hearing a white guy rapping is always good. And secondly, I just want to say that this live Cold Wars podcast was really kind of an affirmation for me. Despite the fact that I got stupid drunk, the whole team I've kind of put together, everyone was just working like clockwork. Everyone was happy to do it. We had a lot of people show up, and a lot of people come up to us and say they really appreciate what we do. And it just meant a lot to me. I mean, everything that I kind of strive for, sort of trying to be for the gamers as opposed to for the companies, which I think a lot of podcasts really have corporations in their pocket that realize it's free advertising. And we certainly do hook Battlefront up, but we're never compensated, or we're never expected to say things. And we've certainly been critical from time to time when we feel like it's warranted. But anyways, we really try to be sort of by gamers for gamers, I guess, really sums it up. And I just feel like the wild success we had at Cold Wars is just an affirmation of the path we're on. And I couldn't be more excited to move on in the future.
Amen. Well, if you're going to stick around for our general contest discussion, that would be wonderful, Stephen. But it's
sure
a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you. And in the future, please feel free to come back on. And certainly, I'm interested as the new books are rolled out in the next few probably the next year, but also with regards to these Vietnam rules. When does that magazine actually come out? Has it come out yet, or is it?
No, it's not out yet, and I'm anxiously awaiting it. I believe the core rules for the new Vietnam set are coming with War Games Illustrated 282, mm-hmm. and it may be on the shelves. I'm a subscriber, which means I usually am the last to get it. So I'm not sure when that comes out, but it should be the next week or two. And I'm pretty excited to read the rules. Initially, I wasn't very excited about Vietnam, but my excitement's starting to grow.
I have the last War Games Illustrated that had the kind of sneak peek into the Vietnam rules. So it's certainly based on that. And there wasn't a lot of VC in that, although it did give some basic army lists. I think maybe even prepping people just to get their painting on and get ready for it.
Sure.
But certainly, yeah, that made me realise that that this 282 issue is going to be one that I'm going to have to pick up myself.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good one. I'm pretty excited about it.
So, we now get into the section of the show that is loosely referred to as the contest section. And we're currently running two contests, although only one of them has been edited and gotten out. The War at Sea contest, have you had an opportunity to hear our last episode yet?
I think I'm about halfway through. Ah. I just got... Well, let's see, what was the last thing I heard? I can't recall now, but it's about halfway there.
So towards the end of the episode, I put the... I don't know. I upped the ante associated with your particular podcast and the War at Sea contest. So I'll wait until you get to that before I disclose any more of that. But anyway, we still have the War at Sea contest open. I was talking to Jonathan. We are getting a small number of entries. They're of a very high quality, but we would like to get more entries, particularly from people in Virginia. And that one, we're probably going to finish up, I think, in the first week of April, the first show that's recorded in April. But the second contest, which I launched last show, and in fact Jonathan edited out the wording associated with this contest from the previous show, I'm starting to call the Comrade Jonathan contest. And Stephen, as you haven't heard this, because it was edited out of the show that you just listened to, Jonathan and I have a running joke here, and it's associated... I'll give you the terms of the contest while I tell you the story. So there's this little website called The Political Compass, and it's something that I have, used and pointed friends at for probably about 3 or 4 years now. It's available on Facebook. It's also available uniquely through a website. And I think it gives a really good indication of someone's political persuasion. And it's something that I've used in the past as a barometer in order to understand people. And no one has ever surprised me. And this is, we're talking about maybe 30, 40 plus friends that have used the Political Compass. I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. You know, they're there or whatever. So my friend Jonathan J. Reinhart, who has been a young Republican, lifelong member of the party, very good, helped out with a number of political campaigns, a number of senatorial races, all these kind of things. And I don't fault the man for that. In fact, everyone needs to have a hobby and a belief system and all this kind of stuff. It's all good. Right. However, when he took the Political Compass, he ended up being someone who, in a political area that I thought was very curious... He, in fact, is a hardline communist, according to the Political Compass. So, let me point out here, Stephen is not laughing disparagingly at you, Jonathan.
No, not at all.
This part's not going to get removed. But the thing that I found particularly curious was that Jonathan really didn't... I mean, my personal background, my father basically is a sociologist, and through my early childhood... He wrote a lot on Marxism and socialism, and we went and, as a small boy, I would go and interview union leaders with my father and all this kind of stuff. So I don't care where Jonathan is politically, but I just find it very curious that out of all the people I know, they've always marked up somewhere where it seemed relatively right. And honestly, talking to Jonathan, I don't know. I'll just let that one rest. But anyway, so the terms of this contest are, go to the Political Compass, fill out the details, you don't need to tell me what you answer or whatever, and then tell me which quadrant you are in. Either left authoritarian, left libertarian, right libertarian. And I will give away 4 paperback copies of my novel Field of Chaos to a randomly selected person from each of the quadrants. And that's the contest, basically. So it's pretty easy to do. Oh, you have to email me tom@nobleape.com, nobleape, tom@nobleape.com. And I will handle the contest because it's not that I don't trust Jonathan, but this is my contest. I'm sending out the prizes. I'd like it to be there. So anyway, that's okay. Currently being called the Comrade Jonathan Field of Chaos Political Compass Contest. And my hope is that will actually make it into the show. But that's our second contest. That will end in the first week of May. But it's a very easy way to get actually a physical copy. There are ways that you can get... free PDF versions as well. Go to my other podcast, Stone Ape. Again, noblaepe.com/stone for that podcast about how you get the free PDF versions. But yeah, that is the Field of Chaos Political Compass contest. And as the role-playing game and the sequel and stuff start coming out, I will be offering those as prizes too. My understanding as well is that Jonathan has a wide variety of t-shirts from TotalCon in a wide variety of different sizes, and we've got to work out how we're actually going to give those away as well. Similarly, my hope is when Henry Hart comes on, we will have electronic... well, we already have electronic versions of Battle Games magazine, but maybe even, if we're particularly nice to Henry, physical subscription to Battle Games that we can put out in a contest in the future. Have you had a chance to see Battle Games magazine?
I think so. I think I have. I can't remember if I'm confusing
it's
it with another.
Red, it kind of has a red border all the way around it, a Battle Games and kind of... eclectic font and the
yeah, I think
games.
That's right. I have, and I think I found it through the CWF
yeah.
site at some point. So yeah, I've poked around. I don't really remember it though.
Yeah, Henry has a very particular style, and I think increasingly he'll be looking for authors such as yourself, myself, potentially even Jonathan to pen articles going into the future. So yeah, Henry has a particular style, but I'm a big fan of his work mainly because it gives a degree of insight in terms of kind of wargaming history as well as kind of modern wargaming. He has a lot of wargamers that you know, really developed the rules in the 60s and 70s, even back to the 50s. He has that kind of historical perspective, but also very much a lot of contemporary flavor as well. And Henry's just an all-round kind of interesting guy who seems to know absolutely everyone in UK wargaming. So generally wonderful character, and it's a pleasure actually to have him as a listener as well. So that's a large reason that all I can say is nice things about him, basically.
Very cool. I'll have that. I'll give that a better look over now that I know a little more about it. I think I was just kind of randomly clicking links and I saw that, and I remember the distinctive red border around the images. I'll check that out. That sounds cool.
So this has been episode 50 of the CWF Gamecast, and my anticipation in the future is that we don't need Jonathan anymore. No, seriously. My anticipation in the future is that there may be more of these, different co-hosts, different people all kind of thrown together. I've got to give shout-outs to Jonathan, though. He is a little unwell still. The zombie flu that had afflicted him for, I guess, maybe 2 or 3 weeks now. Apparently it still affected his voice, so that's the reason he's not here celebrating. But also he said that he thought the show would be in good hands with me, little did he know. But anyway, it's also been a pleasure, like I said, to have Stephen McLaughlin on. And yeah, you've got to come back on, Stephen. And also we've kind of debated doing, I mean, neither Jonathan nor I, Jonathan probably slightly more than me, but neither of us are really heavy Flames of War players. So
right.
our fitting into your particular podcast may be a little bit more eclectic. But in terms of general... historical rants and things like that, I'm pretty sure we could fit in somehow.
Sure, and I know you're particularly interested in the Vietnam War. I know you've talked about it several times, so maybe when we kind of ramp up the Vietnam coverage, we'll get you on as a guest.
Oh,
I think that could be quite interesting. But yeah, thank you guys very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Not a problem. Well, Stephen, I think that's the outro.
All right. Sounds good.
Good night. Wonderful talking with you. Take care.
You as well. Thank you.
See ya.